Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, news director here at KUNM. The Albuquerque Journal published a racist cartoon last week. That the response from people here in New Mexico and the country and the way the journal handled the criticism has raised a bunch of questions about newsroom diversity and media representations of people of color. What did you think of the cartoon the journal ran? Do you think newsrooms in New Mexico need to do better when reporting on communities of color? Call now 277-5866 or tweet with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Joining us today, Andrea Quijada. She is a visual communication scholar and doctoral student at the University of New Mexico in the Art History Department. Kateri Zuni is radio producer and youth coordinator with Generation Justice, a youth media project founded on principles of social justice, media justice, and decolonization. She's also a multimedia journalism student at UNM. And Michelle Salcedo, she's an editor and journalist and former president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
So this cartoon that the Albuquerque Journal published last week, lawmakers, community members, advocacy organizations, even some of the journal's own journalists spoke out against this cartoon and the fact that the journal ran it. The newspaper's response initially made national news. At first, editor-in-chief Karen Moses said the cartoon was intended to spark debate and that they were sorry it hadn't done that. Just as a note, we did invite her to join us this morning, and she didn't respond to that request. The local chapter of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists was among those who pushed back on that initial response. And after a couple of days, the editors at the journal agreed that they shouldn't have run the cartoon. We here at KUNM ran an editorial pointing out the damage that publishing that cartoon does to the public's trust in news. We're going to start briefly with this cartoon, and then we're going to move on to a bigger discussion. But first, I want to get, Kateri, I'll start with you. Initial reactions to this cartoon when you saw it.
Initially, not surprised. I don't think it's far out of what we've seen from outlets like the Journal before. And also, to take a broader look at the history of media within the United States, this is how people of color have always been portrayed to the rest of the community, as barbarous, as savage, as people to be feared. So no, I wasn't surprised. And I'm also not surprised at the way that they handled it either.
Andrea, what about you? What do you think?
So similarly, it's not shocking to me that these are the kinds of images that are being produced. These are what I think did surprise me was the particular pushback this particular cartoon did receive, because this is almost a daily experience of most types of media. So I found that interesting. In terms of basic sort of visual literacy or media literacy work, my interest and sort of interest of the discipline isn't necessarily about what if the image should or should not be printed. It's the questions to ask are, what does this tell us about the culture? What is taking place at this particular time? What is the context that both perpetuated the creation of it, but also the publication and distribution of it? And those are the questions that we want to be asking. And because the context in some ways has not changed, as Kateri just said, that these are not new images, that tells us a lot then about what shifts have actually not taken place in the culture over hundreds of years here. And so I think that the cartoon does two primary things, though. One is it does uncover a problem within any narrative that exists about immigrant people, which is that immigrant people in any narrative are not allowed to just be regular folks. On one end, we have immigrants have to be superheroes who are here in search of a non-existent American dream. And then on the other, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, as in this cartoon, then all immigrants become painted as people who participate in criminal acts. And I don't want to focus on that today. I want to point that out, though, that there's some issues within the narratives themselves that can be addressed. But I want to really get at that this cartoon, what this cartoon does do is it confuses criminal acts with the criminalization of immigrants by a system. And so it's, you know, immigrants are regular people. Some may or may not commit horrific crimes like MS-13. But there is a system now that has made it, has criminalized an entire group of people for simply being in this country with maybe without documentation. And there is a very long history of the U.S., particularly with Mexican immigrants and Mexican immigration, of wanting to scapegoat immigrants when it is economically suitable to do that. And when the labor is needed, they create pathways to ensure that labor is able to cross the border.
Let me go to Michelle. Michelle, you are on the East Coast, and I'm not sure if you heard about this cartoon before we reached out to you. Tell me what struck you about it.
I did hear about the cartoon actually several days ago when Brandon Benavides, the current president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, mentioned that they were in communication with Karen Moses, the editor of the Albuquerque Journal, about this cartoon. However, I hadn't seen the cartoon until this morning when I saw the tweet from the cartoonist Sean Delonis. I think what there were a couple of things that struck me about the image. The first is that dreamers are young people between the ages of, I believe it's 18 and 30. And clearly the people who are depicted in that cartoon were older than that. And they could have been any ethnicity, quite frankly. They could have been North African. They could have been Hispanic. They could have been Middle Eastern. So to me, that kind of speaks to this generalized fear that's been instilled in us since 9/11, to fear the other. Dreamers, for the most part, are very hardworking. They are interested in getting an education. They are struggling for an education since so many states have passed laws saying that they have to, if they're going to go to school, they cannot get any financial aid from state sources or from federal sources, and they need to pay out-of-state tuition. For a lot of folks, that is quite a burden. I think, too, that Lieutenant Governor John Sanchez really had a very interesting statement that he was offended by, as a Republican and offended as a conservative, that the paper would try to depict Democrats, or as the cartoonist would try to depict Democrats, as thugs and terrorists. So I think that instead of encapsulating a view of Americans on immigration, which to a certain extent this does, a very negative view and a very dark view, it certainly encapsulates the view of immigration by the cartoonist. And I think the other thing that's getting lost in the discussion, both in what's been printed and what's been and some of the commentary that's gone around about this, is that most Hispanics in this country are not immigrants, and most Hispanics in New Mexico, even though New Mexico has one of the highest, if not the highest, percentage of Hispanics in its population, most Hispanics in New Mexico have been in the state for generations, 5, 6, 7, 8 generations, and are among some of the original, they are descendants of some of the original settlers from New Spain. So I think that after 6 or 7 or 8 generations, if you can't be viewed as an American, that really speaks volumes about what we know about Latino history in this country, which is very much entwined. It is American history. Latino history in the Southwest is American history. We are not aliens. We are not foreigners. This land is our land.
I'm going to go to Andrea Quijada. Your thoughts on Michelle's comments?
Well, I want to return back to the image itself for a moment and ask one of our basic media literacy questions, too, is always sort of who gains power from what's being printed, who doesn't, who benefits, who doesn't. And I think when we are talking about very strong anti-immigrant messages, there is a tendency for messages like this to want to function, to actually build sort of Hispanic or Latino sort of organizing or in some sort of organization of people then to also become anti-immigrant. And that is actually something we have to pay very close attention to here in New Mexico for the particular reasons that Michelle laid out, which is that we cannot pretend when we're talking about the context of what this means to ignore, and we cannot ignore the fact that we have a, quote, Hispanic governor who is one of the most anti and who became governor on and ran on anti-immigrant ad campaigns and has continued to do that. And so when we talk about, and when I ask and I say, what is the context of this ad, I'm talking about what is happening at the federal level. This ad, this cartoon means something very particular in this moment that it might not mean 50 years from now. And when you're studying visual culture, you always have to be asking, what is the context in which the object was created? And the context is we have a president who recently talked about MS-13 in his State of the Union. The context in this state is a governor that is very anti-immigrant, a mayoral candidate in Santa Fe who recently talked about her Anglo culture being the reason why she went to an Ivy League school. We have a U.S. Attorney General that recently said at the National Sheriff's Association winter meeting that the office of the sheriff is a critical part of the Anglo-American history of law enforcement. So this is the context that I'm talking about when I'm saying that this cartoon means something very specific at this specific time.
Kadri.
Great, thank you. And also, I try to shy away from applying this kind of model minority view of dreamers. And as Andrea had said previously, it builds it up so that if we have a problem or if we have an issue regarding immigrants, then we only are looking to these like shiny examples, and we're not actually recognizing the fact that immigrants are just people, just like us, and they have lives, and they're in everyday situations just like we are. And it doesn't necessarily mean to be a dreamer that you're this huge, you know, academic scholar, and you're making these, like, you could just be a regular person making it as you can. And I think that's important to recognize.
How does we're talking about some of these narratives that have been perpetuated in news coverage, and we're kind of focusing on news coverage right now. That's not to say that these narratives aren't also reproduced and reiterated in, you know, movies and TV shows and whatever, right? But we're focusing on news content right now. Kateri, can you talk a little bit about how these kinds of narratives, the stereotypical narratives, racist narratives about people of color in news coverage affects communities of color? Like, what are some of the actual real examples of how damaging this coverage can be to communities?
Well, I think perhaps one of the most pervasive and, for me, insidious ways that racist narrative works is from within. I feel like racism works from within. And so it creates this idea inside your own head as a young person of color, especially in New Mexico, living under this like history of repeated colonization. These images and these narratives put this idea in your head that you actually don't belong there, that you don't belong in that newsroom or in that editorial staff making those decisions. And it kind of makes you question, you know, whether or not this is in fact my story. Is this really the story of me? Is this really the story of my people? And so in many ways, it works from within outward. And, you know, not to mention or not to forget that, you know, it also has an effect on how others see the rest of us. And so it finds its way into hiring practices. It finds its way into who gets to be in the position of power within a media outlet, just to name a couple.
We're going to continue. We're going to continue, and we're going to get into this newsroom diversity question as well a little bit later in the show. Right now, I want to remind folks, we are looking for your calls this morning. We'd like to hear what you think about what we're talking about today. Do you often take issue with news content and the way people of color are represented in news stories? Where do you find the best coverage of communities of color in news in New Mexico? Call now, 277-5866. That's 277-5866. You can also tag us in a tweet. Use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. My name is Elaine Baumgartel, and we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
This week on This American Life, Michael and Joan fell for each other. He was in prison. She was not. And as long as he was in prison, things were great. Romantic, even. They wrote love letters. They missed each other. And then he got out. And as you'd expect, it got a lot more complicated. What happened next? This week.
Sundays at 4 on KUNM.
He is an astonishingly gifted pianist and violinist, and he's 16 years old, which means, yeah, Rei Ushikubo spends a little time practicing.
I usually try to do 4 hours of piano and 4 hours of violin every day.
Coming up, Rei Ushikubo plays a love song for violin on the next performance today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. I'm the news director here at KUNM. We're speaking with Andrea Quijada. She is a media literacy consultant. She used to work with the New Mexico Media Literacy Project. Kateri Zuni is here as well. She's a radio producer and youth coordinator with Generation Justice. And Michelle Salcedo is an editor and journalist. She's joining us by phone from, you're in D.C., right, Michelle?
Yes, I am.
So, Michelle, I want to go to you now and bring this question of stereotypical narratives in news coverage, and what kind of environment does that create for journalists of color in newsrooms across the country?
Well, I have never been in a newsroom, and I've worked in 4 different newsrooms now. I've never worked in a newsroom where, there has been overt I've been overtly targeted, or there have been overt attacks on Latinos in the newsroom. But with that said, there are, I think all you have to do is look at the latest survey of the American Society of News Editors, also known as ASNI, to see how little progress we've made in the 40 years now that they've been doing their newsroom census. And, something like 86% of all newsroom leaders remain white. Of all minorities, only 20% are leaders, 79% are non-leaders in the newsroom. And that those numbers hold true for Hispanics and for Blacks. And ironically, there are, and frankly, for Asians as well. It's about 20% of all Blacks in a newsroom are in leadership positions. 20% of all Hispanics in a newsroom are in leadership positions. What does this mean? It means that the decisions about the daily news report, about hiring, about stories that are run, are mostly made by people who are not, especially in urban areas, who are not part of the broader community. And that affects coverage. So I can't help but think that if there were, and I don't know what the makeup of the Albuquerque Journal editorial board is, what the ethnic and racial makeup is, but I can't help but think that if there were more Latinos, more people of color on that editorial board, the discussion would have been a different one than the one that was had about that cartoon.
So to that end, I believe there are people of color working at the Journal. I don't think that it is representative compared to the population of New Mexico. So in the sense that the majority of folks in New Mexico identify as Hispanic, and based on what I understand about the Journal, a majority of the folks working at the Journal, including at editorial and management levels, are not Hispanic. So that's not necessarily reflected. We got a couple of Twitter comments here. The cartoon and the damage control apology were a slap in the face to everyone in Albuquerque. Another Twitter comment from Greg from the Pueblo of Acoma. He says the Journal should do more coverage of communities of color. And let's take a call right now from Mike in Albuquerque. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is actually a really, you know, good conversation. It's an interesting conversation. But I urge people not to lose sight, especially those in New Mexico. This is the largest paper in the state of New Mexico. And to understand about the Journal, this is not new. This is historic. The paper is kind of a publication wing of a larger corporation, a development corporation. And they use the paper to bludgeon whoever gets in their way. And, I mean, I personally haven't subscribed to the paper in, like, 15, 20 years, and I urge all my friends not to subscribe to it, because that cartoon, that political cartoon, was almost perfect. The only thing it left out was unions. It's a racist institution, hates the Democratic Party. So, I mean, they couldn't resist to publish it, because it is who they are. And it didn't have a slam on unions, which would have made it even more perfect for them.
Let me pause you there, Mike. Thanks so much for your comment. Just to acknowledge that the Albuquerque Journal is a large organization, and there are a lot of folks who work there who don't have any say on what the editorial cartoons are. And some of the journalists at the Albuquerque Journal spoke out on Twitter. A couple of the Latino Hispanic journalists spoke out on Twitter saying, hey, we're not okay with this. So there is a conversation about, hey, do you not support a news organization that provides a lot of really critical and important information to the communities that it serves? And that's part of the conversation we're having here, right, is how do folks have an impact on the way their news organizations serve the community? Let's go to Ivy in Albuquerque. Good morning, Ivy. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hi, good morning. Yeah, I just want to jump in on that. And I sent you guys a tweet a few minutes ago about what's my response to that cartoon. That is a slap in the face to the Latino Hispanic community. You know, 50 years ago, those cartoons were regular material in newspapers all around the country. And we're going back to 1968, where media outlets did not represent the true fabric of our country. You didn't see Hispanics or African Americans or even Asians or women in local media making decisions. And we're going back to that level now. And one of the things I've been pretty vocal on Twitter, calling out local media, including the Journal, for not covering Hispanic Heritage Month, Asian Pacific Islander Month, and right now African American Black History Month, and only doing wire copy and not interviewing residents of the community. And one TV station in particular, I'm not going to mention the station, they don't even cover the month. They're not covering Black History Month except using press junket interviews with celebrities. That's a slap in the face. And they did the same for Asian Pacific Heritage Month, which is next month. We've got to make some decisions. You know, we've got to say to the media, hey, the editorial board of the Journal is predominantly white. We know that most of the journalists are very diverse. We've got to let them know, put them on notice saying we are not going to stand for this anymore.
Thanks, Ivy, so much for your comments. Andrea, you wanted to pick up from there.
Oh, I wanted to comment on this idea of what it means to go back or forward or what that looks like. Because this idea that somehow there's been so much progression when, in fact, if I really encourage listeners to check out a book called News for All the People by my colleagues Joe Torres and Juan Gonzalez, who lay out historically the role that communities of color across the United States played in creating local media. In 1968 in New Mexico, we actually had Latino-owned newspapers. And so I think it's really critical that we think about also what it means to go back or not, because we did have a broader, there was broader sort of diversity, to use that term, in representation and in media. I also want to point out that terms like Latino or Hispanic are these racialized terminologies that have been created to, in these broad brushstrokes, to encapsulate, you know, when I hear this, the idea of community, it's like, well, what does that mean? Because technically, if we are a community, Susana Martinez is in my community. And I don't think that that politically is something that I'm completely comfortable with. And when we look at representation of who's in the who's in what rooms, it's not just who's in the room. It's what stories are being covered and the framing that gets to use. Because just because someone is in the room doesn't mean that they're actually going to use a frame that is supportive. And I continue to say this. We are in New Mexico with a governor who identifies as Hispanic. So we have to be very careful that we are not creating these broad brushstrokes and lumping together groups of people. I think we need to be a lot more specific in our language.
Cater, your thoughts? I know you use that text with your work with students at Generation Justice.
We do. It actually plays a big role in our curriculum, not only for our youth producers, but for our journalism fellows, which is actually how I started out within the program. And it does take you back to the very beginning, the very inception of media within this country. And just as Andrea said, it's not that we're going backwards. It's that the media as we know it is continually finding new ways to create those narratives of people of color. And this is just one of the latest iterations of that. It's not a new thing, and it's not a going backwards thing. It's part of a very clear and intentional narrative of the people of color in this community and in our country.
Andrea.
It is also a way to, it's not just about what gets created, it's also access to distribution. And at a time right now when net neutrality continues to be threatened, when that is one of the few paths of distribution that more people of color have access to than not. Again, I want to be very clear, not everyone has access, but it has provided the role of net neutrality, in particular in challenging these kinds of narratives or being able to put out our own narratives. I cannot stress enough that this is also part of the context that we're functioning in, is that what gets laid out in the book by Joe and Juan is this very clear sense of how distribution is throttled every step of the way.
Michelle, in D.C., former president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, I want to come back to you with this. You mentioned earlier the ASNI survey of newsroom diversity. We put a link to that on our website at KUNM.org. I also linked to NPR's staffing diversity numbers from 2017. And both of those reports show very little change in the number of people of color working in newsrooms in the U.S. from like 2016 to 2017. Michelle, can you talk a little bit about how there is or isn't change happening in newsrooms?
There hasn't been change happening in newsrooms. I mean, the ASNI survey came on my radar when I first started my career, although these many years ago. And I think at the time they had a 10 or 15 year goal to have parity for racial and ethnic, for people of color in the community to, for people of color in the newsroom to reflect the community. And every year the numbers would pretty much not move. There has been very, very little progress, and their solution was to push out the deadline farther and farther. And so now here we are in 2018, and we still see that about, we still see 6% of the newsroom is African American, about 6% of the newsroom is Hispanic, not even 1% of the newsroom is Native American, and in a state like New Mexico, where there is a high, or in Arizona, where there are high populations of Native Americans, how are you going to tell the story of a large portion of your state if you don't have people on the staff who are familiar with those communities?
What about
something else? I'd like to.
Sure.
There's something else I'd like to go back to that that Andrea said, and it's a very good point. We are Latino and Hispanic are basically census terms in order to be able to count people from Spanish-speaking countries. We are Latinos and Hispanics, whatever you want to call yourself. We are a very, very diverse group, predominantly in the United States, predominantly Mexican, but there is representation from all 23 Latin American countries in various degrees. We need to, this is a little bit of a tangent, but we ourselves need to become familiar with the different cultures within that frame. And I think that one of the things that Juan and Joe's book points out is that a lot of Latinos, a lot of people of color started their own publication so that they would have a voice because they had no voice in the mainstream papers. Their opinions were not valued. They were not looked upon as news sources. Their communities were denigrated. And so people started their own papers to keep their communities informed.
Michelle, I want to ask you about digital newsrooms. Andrea brought up the internet. We know that newsrooms have experienced a contraction, newspapers especially. And then there's a proliferation of news sources online. What do we know about staffing diversity in digital newsrooms compared to print and broadcast newsrooms?
So that we have less information of our own creation and of our own making. It is more difficult for us to tell our own stories than it has been in the past.
Great. Let's go to a phone call from Clifton in Albuquerque. Good morning, Clifton. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm just now reading Roxana Dunbar Ortiz's book, The Indigenous Indigenous People's History of the United States, and just finished a portion of the Jacksonian era regicide, genocide of Native American populations. And they always expressed this as, they were just reaching out for land. They were dispossessing Native Americans of land, and yet they always expressed this as protecting their white folks from the depredations, so dehumanizing the Native Americans. And that's exactly what this cartoon is continuing. Your panel is exactly correct. Nothing has changed. This is just a continual dehumanization of the other. And I'm reminded of a line from a play that says, "You must quit grafting virtuousness to viciousness." And that's what I see here. Thank you.
Thanks, Clifton. Let's go to Leonor in Albuquerque. Leonor, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you very much for letting me speak. Yes, I've been listening to the conversation, and I don't know who Joe and Juan are, but I know I read the book written by one of the professors at the university, A Decade of Betrayal. And Mexicans have been, deported for decades. My father was born in Chicago, but raised in Mexico. When he came to the U.S. when he was 30 in the 1950s, he was not treated as an American. He was treated like a Mexican. And it's something that has been going on. As far as publications of Spanish-speaking papers, we had them in Chicago, Indiana, in the 1960s and the 50s. It's just different parts of the country. Now, one thing, and I know I'm all over the place, but one thing I was really taken aback when I came to New Mexico, of how people didn't want to identify with being Mexican. I was born in Mexico. In Indiana, I had no shame saying I was Mexican. Here, my daughter's husband told me just last year that she was the first person that ever identified with being Mexican. And I thought, in New Mexico, with so many Mexicans living here? And it was in Clovis, it was the same thing. You know, and I'm going, we have so many more people in elected offices here in New Mexico, yet that are of what, Latino descent or whatever they want to identify themselves. Yet you still have so many places in New Mexico that don't want to identify as being Mexican, of Mexican origin. That to me is a huge dichotomy that I don't understand.
It is an unusual situation here in New Mexico. We have a very unique history, and we did have a really, really in-depth conversation about this exact question of racial identity and ethnic identity, Hispanic, Latino, Chicano, Indigenous, this conversation a couple of weeks ago on this show. And so that audio is posted on our website as well. I encourage folks who are interested in going down that path and that part of the conversation to check out that show. Also, News for All the People, that is the book that both Andrea and Kateri are referring to. Juan Gonzalez and Joe Torres are the authors of that book. Kateri, you wanted to respond to Leonard.
Yeah, I just think that when we think about the ways that New Mexicans specifically identify themselves or ourselves, it all goes back to the fact that we've experienced perpetual colonization. These identities were actually a way to protect ourselves from further land theft, from, you know, having our culture removed again from our hands. And so, you know, that's really what we're talking about when we talk about the work of changing narrative. We're talking about decolonization. And, you know, that's where those habits that we see nowadays actually come from. It's a defense mechanism in a lot of ways.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and we're talking about racism in the news and newsroom diversity. What would you like to see newsrooms do differently when covering communities of color in New Mexico? The number to call right now is 277-5866. That's 277-5866. You can also send us an email, and that address is letstalk@kunm.org. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Fewer people are leaving it to fate to find their match these days. If you'd rather go online to see if your one love, your car, is a match for your other love, KUNM, just go to KUNM.org to the support tab and click Donate Your Vehicle. It'll tell you everything you need to know if your car or truck is a match for KUNM's vehicle donation program. If you'd rather, you can always call 888-KUNM-CAR.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reports cardiovascular, or heart disease, is at the top of the list when it comes to taking the lives of women in this country. Have you or a loved one been affected by heart disease? We hope you'll join us for our discussion on Native women's heart health on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. We're speaking with Andrea Quijada. She is a media literacy consultant. She used to work with the New Mexico Media Literacy Project. She is also a doctoral student at the University of New Mexico in the art history department. We also have Kateri Zuni. She is radio producer and youth coordinator with Generation Justice. She's also a multimedia journalism student at UNM. And Michelle Salcedo. She's an editor and journalist and former president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. She's joining us by phone this morning, and we're going to go to some of our callers right now. Jose Luis, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, everybody. I really appreciate you taking the time today to take my call. I just wanted to, you know, talk a little bit about what's on topic and also connect that to the overall political world that goes on in New Mexico. I think that reducing racial and ethnic disparities is an extremely important topic in today's world, especially in New Mexico. Some of the folks there commented on the diversity in the Latino and Hispanic communities. And in New Mexico, there is a very wide, diverse population within that, and we all say within the grassroots community that Hispanic and Latino are fake identities, and their identity and their core identity and culture. And, you know, that's very important in erasure tactics for from other majority groups. And in New Mexico, Hispanic, Latino folks who identify as that, that might actually be the descendants of Genizaro people who are also indigenous. And I think that that's a topic that isn't widely talked about nor accepted. I think a lot of people know that the Genizaro people exist, but they're not willing to have that conversation of the indigeneity of these people, the extreme culture and land loss, and the disparities that these invisible folks experience on a day-to-day and also within the political world. The Hispanics seem to be taking over the legislature, and the Genizaro folks from land-grant communities, small communities that have historically since forever been political pawns, have no voice or representation within that. So I just wanted to touch on that and also connect the, you know, the fact that there is a large number of murdered and missing indigenous women, and our women seem to be and have consistently been at the front lines of this struggle and disparity, and just want to pay respects to those folks because our indigenous women are extremely oppressed. And yeah, that's my piece.
Thanks.
You so much.
Thanks, Jose Luis. I want to go to you, Kateri. How do you approach the work with students at Generation Justice using this frame of like, hey, folks aren't taught the true history of New Mexico? How do you use that as a foundation for the work that you then do with the young folks?
Right. Well, I mean, understanding the history of New Mexico is to understand the history of colonization here. And so I feel like if we're going to have representation in the media, we also need to have a very intentional foundation of analysis when it comes to the history of our state, especially. And so we do things like add to our curriculum books like News for All the People. We take a very, very intentional multiracial and multicultural approach to our project to ensure that the narratives that we are creating are changing the greater narrative that is built around our communities in this state.
Andrea, when you are an instructor at UNM as well, in addition to doing your doctoral work, art history, visual communication.
Yes.
So how do you work with these ideas in your work with students at the University of New Mexico?
Well, anytime we're looking at an image, it's for me, it's always about, and within the discipline, it's about setting up what is the history of representation around this particular issue. So or even comparing it with what's actually taking place. So in my class, it's Art History 101, which is an introduction essentially to visual culture. So that's how I approach it. So we start with doing basic visual literacy, media literacy components, and then from there, build into the ability to do a formal analysis and an iconological analysis on any object or image. And for me, it's incredibly important for students to understand the connections between what may be taking place, what's a contemporary campaign or ad campaign in particular, and looking at the history of how has, for example, soap been represented? What does it mean when Dove creates the campaign that they produced last year? And so
that one, mention quickly what that was for folks.
So that was one where it showed someone using a black woman using Dove and taking off her sweatshirt. And then because she was clean, she was now white. And that
they got a ton of feedback.
Yes.
Negative feedback after they ran that
yes.
ad campaign. They pulled it too, didn't they?
They did. And it's interesting because they also we also did that sort of apology that's like, we're sorry people felt something and not mm-hmm. we're actually sorry we participated in this structural racism. That's a historical problem that is rooted in soap ads from over 100 years ago. And the truth is, even when we set that up, and I can set it up as well as I can, there's still pushback because we have to remember that seeing something, when we talk about visual culture and being able to do a visual analysis, it's not just, not everyone is literally seeing the same thing, because seeing is actually about perception. Perception is rooted in our positions or positionalities, which are often get connected to our identifiers, right? Or which some people will say identities. And I wanted to come back to that word a moment too, because one of my mentors at UNM, Dr. Kirsten Pye Buick, is very clear that language must always remain active, and that there's no such thing as an identity, but that there are identifiers, and that those are always in constant movement as we walk in and out of space.
And that we use them on ourselves as well as on other people.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that when we use the word identity implies that it's static, that it doesn't change, which is also a problem when we talk about Latino identity. It's like, well, no, because there's not just one. And but when you talk about identifiers, that opens up the space for us to have a much more nuanced and deeper conversations. So within this, to go back to this idea, though, of perception, what that means then is if I can perceive something based on my identifiers, I am limited then also. If I'm not willing to acknowledge how my identifiers influence my perception, I will literally not see something the same way. And what I encourage my students to do is to really understand how those identifiers can impact perception.
Michelle, I want to go to you. This idea of folks being aware of where they're coming from themselves, it's something that I use in the journalism classes that I teach, right? This idea of knowing where your view of the world comes from, and knowing what you think about the world helps you to then be able to tell stories that are other people's stories. Can you talk a little bit about how that dynamic functions for journalists?
We all have our own filters, and I think the point that Andrea makes is an important one. I think it's really important to be aware of where we come from, what our cultural roots are, so that we have a better understanding of our own filters and our own lenses. With that said, if we are ever going to and I hesitate to use this phrase, but for lack of a better one, if we are ever going to get beyond a quote-unquote post-racial world, we need to be able to understand that we all have these filters, and they are not good or bad. They are the filters that we have for whatever reason, and that other people have those past filters as well. And in order to get beyond those filters so that we can have some kind of shared understanding, and dare I even say empathy, we need to have conversations that are open and non-judgmental and come from a place of curiosity rather than offense or superiority or smugness or conceit or whatever other adjective you want to use.
Michelle, I'm going to pause you right there so I can take a couple of calls real quick, because we're coming up towards the end of the show. I'm going to take a couple calls really quickly. So folks, when I take your call, if you can give us your main number one thought right quick so that I can get as many folks on as possible. Andres in Española, you're on the air. What's your quick thought for us at the end of the show?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Well, like the other callers mentioned, you know, the lack of true identification of the Hispanic and the Mexican and the different cultures that are here, especially here in northern New Mexico, being such a high amount of individuals that do like fall into the Genízaros and the New Mexico Sephardic Judaism and the different cultures that actually came here, from different other countries like Spain and so forth, and yet not through the Mexican lineage, but yet we're all labeled as Mexicans. And little do they know that most of the Hispanic and people here are like half Indians. You know, you find a lot of Spanish surnames, even in the pueblos, you know, here, especially again here in northern New Mexico. It's a very, very highly intertwined cultures here.
Thanks so much, very much, for your comment, Andres. Let's go quickly to Austin in Albuquerque. Can you give me your comment real short and succinct?
Sure. I was fortunate to go through a media literacy training with Media Literacy Project and Ms. Quijada several years ago. And I've never been able to look at media the same sense, and I'm just really grateful for that. And, you know, people like me, and I'm thinking most of us in New Mexico, are more likely to be the subject of news stories rather than have control over the narrative and who's in power in the newsroom. And, you know, the Journal published this cartoon because of who's in power with that editorial board. And so I can't think of anything more important than for us to be educated and engaged consumers, and for us to help our family, friends, and colleagues become more educated consumers. And that's what Media Literacy Project did. And I'm really grateful that Ms. Quijada is continuing this important work in the classroom. And I just think that we need an exponential level of that kind of education throughout our state and country. Thanks so much.
Great, Austin. Thanks. We're going to take one last call. Adrienne in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. My name's Adrienne here in Albuquerque. I just really appreciative of this show, and I too have been blessed to be have some mentorship and camaraderie with Ms. Quijada. I want to say that coming out of the legislative session now, seeing all the politicians grandstanding about how much they stood against this cartoon, but yet would go and vote for policies that criminalize young people, that criminal, that further re-incriminate our young people. And so it was heartbreaking to me to be in those places when, you know, folks are taking this strong stance publicly on social media about how they stand against it, but in the same time voting for policies that actually hurt. We know that the criminal justice system disproportionately impacts communities of color. So it is an indigenous community. So I just wanted to, you know, sort of say that there's a larger need for even for our progressive champions to have an understanding around how this media representation and their ability to use it also impacts the way they vote on policy. Thank you.
Thanks, Adrienne, for your comment. We're coming up to the end of the show. I want to go to each of our panelists for a closing thought. And the questions that I have on my mind are, what's next? Where do we go from here? And what are recommendations for journalists, for media consumers, for the folks who are purchasing news content or consuming news content? What's your number one recommendation? Michelle, in D.C., I'm going to come to you first on that.
I think we still have to, the community still has to, and when I say the community, I don't mean the Latino community. The community at large needs to push newsroom leaders for a newsroom that better reflects them and a newsroom that more accurately tells the stories of the readership.
Fantastic. Andrea. Recommendation.
Understand that visual culture is a visual language. We need the tools and abilities to be able to speak that language and to understand what's going on. And in order to do that, we have to know the history of visual culture as well.
Kateri, your recommendation?
I think, of course, representation within the news media is step one, but I think step zero is providing media makers with an understanding of the history with a truthful analysis. And that's really the work of what Generation Justice is.
Fantastic. Thank you. Kateri Zuni, she is radio producer and youth coordinator with Generation Justice. That's a youth media project founded on principles of social justice, media justice, and decolonization. She's also a multimedia journalism student at the University of New Mexico. Andrea Quijada is a visual communication scholar, media literacy consultant, and she's also a doctoral student at the University of New Mexico in the art history department. We were also joined by Michelle Salcedo. She's an editor and journalist, former president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Thanks to everyone who called in and commented or added questions to our show this morning. The conversation doesn't have to end here. You can email your comments to letstalk@kunm.org. You can tweet us using the hashtag letstalknm or find us on Facebook. Search for KUNM Radio. We podcast the show on kunm.org and iTunes. We'll post that audio shortly after we finish the show today. Thanks to all of you again. And Marino Spencer is our engineer today. Sarah Trujillo screened your calls. Victor Onimale live tweeted the show. May Ortega assisted with production. Thanks to the D Numbers in Santa Fe for letting us use their music for our theme music. We'll be back next Thursday morning at 8. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and this is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.